The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. The role of genetic testing and counseling for the general internist is presented by Dr. Robert Hasty.
So it's a pleasure to talk to you today about a very important board topic, genetics. And so I'm going to be focusing mostly on the high-yield stuff, things that I think that they'll be asking you on the boards. And we'll just start off by just talking about some of the chromosomal abnormalities, Down syndrome, Klinefelter, Turner syndrome, and then the Fragile X MR syndrome. So I'll first start off just by talking a little bit about Down syndrome, trisomy 21. And I think that the important thing for you to recall when you're studying for the boards, you know, a classic question is, you know, what malignancies are increased in patients with Down syndrome? And the answer is ALL. So, you know, it's like one of those things, if you see ALL, Down syndrome, you don't even have to read the rest of the question. Early Alzheimer's is very, very common in patients with Down syndrome. In fact, you know, it's very unusual to have a patient who's 40 years old with trisomy 21 who does not have some degree of Alzheimer's disease. Of course, the VSD and AV canal defects from a cardiovascular standpoint are classically associated. So ALL, early Alzheimer's, VSD and AV, those are the big points on Down. So next up is, let me go back to this. So if you look at atlanto-axial instability, patients with Down syndrome very commonly have at least some degree of atlanto-axial instability. And the reason why this is important is, you know, you're probably doing pre-op clearances for these patients, and if they do have atlanto-axial instability, you do a typical endotracheal intubation, you know, they have a very good chance to have a, you know, C-spine injury, and you could kill the patient. One time I had a patient with Down syndrome that had been taken care of for several years, at an outpatient. I'm mostly, you know, hospitalist by practice, you know, over most of my career, but I was practicing some university clinic type of a practice there for a number of years. So I'd been taking care of this guy. I go away on vacation. He has a hernia surgery. Actually, I hadn't cleared him for surgery. Somebody else had. And sure enough, he died, you know, perioperatively. And I'm convinced they just, you know, because they hadn't screened for atlantoaxial instability. And of course, this is also true of rheumatoid arthritis. Maybe they talked about this when, you know, during your RA lectures. So just think about that. And so the screen would be to do dynamic C-spine radiographs. So if you just, you know, order some dynamic C-spine radiographs in patients with Down syndrome or the RA, and then obviously if they do have it, you do the fiber optic intubation, you know, instead of, you know, tipping their head back and stuff like that, you know, something you can tell the anesthesiologist. Actually, there was a guy, and I think it was maybe last year, the board review, I had mentioned this, and he was at some large, he told me where it was, some large academic center, and he was, you know, internal medicine and anesthesiology boarded, and he had he said like every year about one of the anesthesiology residents would miss atlantoaxial instability in patients and with disastrous outcomes, and was always one of those M&Ms and stuff like that. So always be mindful of that, and a classic board question. All right, so the next one up is gonna be Klinefelter syndrome, also 47. And they phenotypically, or genotypically, they appear as XXY. And so classically, they have an increased risk of germ cell tumor. So think about testicular cancer in patients with Klinefelter syndrome. They also typically will have infertility. They have the small testes, you know, the small testicular mass. And they typically are tall with a unicoid habitus. So think about Klinefelter, usually tall, small testes, and testicular cancer is very common, germ cell tumors. All right, so the next one up is Turner syndrome. And I remember, I used to be down in Florida for a number of years. We had a physician, and she was, she'd actually would share publicly that she actually had Turner syndrome. So it shows you that, they have normal mentation. So she was able to go through medical school and practice medicine. It's associated with coarctation and bicuspid aorta. That's Turner syndrome. Next up is the Fragile X mental retardation syndrome, or Fragile X, syndrome. And they sometimes they'll look just normal, or sometimes they have like this kind of a thin face, real large jaw. They have very large testicular mass, very large testes. And of course they have the MR, cognitive delay. I should be, more appropriate nowadays to talk about. So that's Fragile X. All right, so next I'm going to switch over to some of the autosomal dominant conditions that most likely they may ask you on your boards. And this includes Marfan syndrome, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, the BRCA mutations, hereditary spherocytosis, Huntington's disease, familial hypercholesterolemia, Lynch syndrome, the MENs, PCKD, von Willebrand's disease, HOCM, myotonic dystrophy. And just a quick little genetics review. So if you have one parent who's phenotypically present with the autosomal dominant condition, and that person has, say, four children, there's a 50% chance that each child will have that phenotypical characteristic. So just kind of a... And that's one of those things they always ask on like level one of the boards or something, right? But sometimes we forget. All right, so the first one is that I'm going to spend a little time is Marfan syndrome, classically associated with the President Lincoln syndrome, mitral valve prolapse, and ascending aortic dilatation is very common because it's that fibrillin gene. They have that fibrillin gene mutation in there, and so that causes some problems with the mitral valve, so they classically have mitral valve prolapse, ascending aortic dilatation. Typically, they'll have an ectopic lens. Sometimes, the optometrist or ophthalmologist will actually pick up a person with Marfan syndrome because the ectopic lens, the fibrillin gene seen on genetic testing, and you can test for it. So the next autosomal dominant condition is Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. And this is a collagen defect. Obviously, they have that hypermobility, the fragile skin, mitral valve prolapse, arterial aneurysms, organ ruptures. So you have to be careful about organ ruptures in these folks. And actually, a little bit of crossover almost with Marfan syndrome. Now, I won't spend too much time on BRCA mutations, but if a person does have BRCA mutations, obviously they have about a 50 to 80% risk of having breast cancer. And, one thing that we frequently forget about is that about 1% of all patients with breast cancer are male. But if you do see a male patient with breast cancer, most likely they have BRCA two mutation, or more commonly. So something to think about if you do see a male patient, to think about doing that genetic, testing. And sometimes that can be very helpful for, genetic counseling and family members and those type of things. So hereditary spherocytosis is another autosomal dominant condition. It's a classically cytoskeleton defect. They have pigmented gallstones, most likely due to hemolysis. Those are the ones that you actually do see on, X-rays and those type of things. Sometimes a splenectomy is helpful in some of those patients. It might, help with some of the hemolysis that they kind of have. But that's hereditary spherocytosis. And then Huntington's disease, it's the HTT gene mutation. You can actually test for it. CAG, nucleotide repeat, so... I guess they could just give you a whole bunch of CAGs on the test and what's, which condition is likely present here? And the answer would be Huntington's disease. Yeah, I remember a few years ago, I was taking care of this lady in the hospital, and I think it was just like a cholecystectomy or something like that. But I was doing, a little bit of family history, and turns out, her dad had Huntington's disease, and she'd actually never been tested, but she had four children, and so chances are two of them actually probably had, Huntington's disease, and it was almost like, kind of like an ethical thing, right? No one had actually done genetic testing with her. She knew that there was some hereditary component, and there might have been a little bit of denial about it, but I felt really bad, that a lot of risk there, and probably some ethical questions that probably arose, but so we actually recommended strongly for her to get, Huntington's testing, and she said she was going to follow up as outpatient. So nowadays, for Huntington's disease, they do have a formal recommendation now that everybody should get an hour of genetic counseling prior to testing, because obviously, if someone's seen a family medicine or a relative in the family that had Huntington's disease, and then they actually find out that they have it too, you have to be careful, right? It could be like almost suicidal. It's for those of you that have seen, patients with Huntington's disease, I mean, it can be, really kind of traumatic. I remember the first time I saw it was this guy in the nursing home. He was like, 42 years old or something like that, and, just suffering severely. And I can just imagine if that was my family member and then I got diagnosed with it, knowing that I'm going to have the condition and, or most likely have the condition in 20, 25 years or something like that. It could be like really, problematic from a psychological standpoint. So, and by the way, genetic counseling, I don't know how it is where you all are, but, genetic counselors are actually kind of tough to find nowadays. Huge demand. There's not enough training for genetic counselors. And, so sometimes it's tricky to actually get genetic counseling done nowadays. So next is another autosomal dominant condition called Lynch syndrome. This is responsible for about 1 out of 20 cases of colon cancer, hereditary non-polyposis colon cancer. So about 1 out of 20 colon cancers. So obviously the genetic condition commonly associated with colon cancer, Lynch syndrome. So I'll just spend a minute talking a little bit about the MENs, types 1A, 1, 2A, and 2B. And then there's an MEN4 too, but that's similar to type 1. And there's all sorts of different mnemonics, but I always remember with type 1, pity, para, pan. If I remember pity, para, pan, I always remember to kind of get that. But they typically have tumors of the parathyroid, pituitary, pancreas. So pity would be pituitary, para would be parathyroid and pancreas, the pan. And hyperparathyroidism is the most common sign. So if you see somebody with hyperparathyroidism, which of the following, MEN types could it be? It would be MEN type 1. So types 2A and 2B would be medullary thyroid carcinoma. That's the classic association with it. One time I was... We'd introduced ultrasound in one of my previous medical schools, and we were doing ultrasound on the students and everything. We actually had a radiologist in the room, training the students, and sure enough, it was thyroid day, and they were, testing, each other's thyroid with the ultrasound, and sure enough, somebody had a little, irregularity on the thyroid, the ultrasound. Of course, radiologist walks over, oh, yeah, this is a, pretty common thyroid cyst, and he says, no, you got to need to get this checked out. So sure enough, the medical student actually had medullary carcinoma, most likely a MEN type 2. But, I mean, it's pretty rare, right? And had it not been that she'd gone to the medical school and had we not put, ultrasound in the curriculum, she probably would have had it diagnosed many years later. And it probably it could have been a lethal condition. So it was just one of those, good things that kind of happened. So, by the way, have you heard there's this theory out there that Abraham Lincoln, he had Marfan's. Everybody said he was like Marfanoid, Marfan syndrome, but they actually think that he had type 2B medullary. He didn't have medullary, as far as we know, but they think he had type 2B MEN. And if you look, he has like that mole on the right face, had that Marfanoid features. He had the rough lips. All those are could potentially be MEN type 2B. So a while back, this guy wrote this whole thesis on it. And I guess if they find some, you know, Lincoln DNA that could actually do DNA testing for it. So kind of interesting. Polycystic kidney disease, one or two gene mutations strongly associated with intracranial aneurysm. So, you know, polycystic kidney disease associated with PKD1 or two gene mutations. You can test for it nowadays and, you know, think about intracranial aneurysm. So obviously that patient with PKD, if they have the worst headache of their life or something like that, you got to think about, you know, some type of aneurysmal rupture, those type of things. All right, so this is, believe it or not, one of the most commonly diagnosed bleeding disorders in America is von Willebrand's disease. And even though it's autosomal dominant, which means it should be 50% male and 50% female, many more women are actually diagnosed with von Willebrand's disease than men. And that's because the women actually have heavy menstrual cycles if they have von Willebrand's disease. And, you know, there's like a mild, moderate, you know, severe types of von Willebrand disease. And so, you know, a lot more of the folks, and, you know, the men are probably diagnosed if they have the severe, but the women, maybe if they have a mild or moderate, because they're having heavy menstrual flow, and they get worked up eventually, you know, after transfusions and those type of things. So so women are more commonly diagnosed, but it's, you know, theoretically, it's equal in both genetically, but it's just, you know, it's where it's detected. So hokum, I won't spend too much time on hokum, but, you know, it's just one of those things on the boards. I always, you know, have like suppressed memories of always getting asked this question. I can never remember if the you know, the hand grip increases or decreases the murmur, but I guess, you know, it decreases the murmur. So hand grip decreases the murmur, and so it's always one of those things that's good to kind of memorize. All right, so one of the last autosomal dominant conditions I'll mention is myotonic dystrophy. And basically, this is a triplet repeat of the myotin or myotonin protein kinase gene. And they'll typically have EEGs with these prolonged rhythmic discharges. And it is a type of muscular dystrophy. It's typically seen in the second or third decade. So muscular dystrophy-like syndrome, you know, typically not found until the second or third decade. So something an internist could easily, you know, see in their practice. And then they have those that characteristic prolonged rhythmic discharges on the EEG. So that's myotonic dystrophy. So here are some of the autosomal recessive conditions that you'll see. Alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, cystic fibrosis, hemochromatosis, sickle cell, the thalassemias, and Wilson's disease. And so if you remember the cartoon for autosomal recessive conditions, you know, let's just say here that the both parents are carriers, so both of them have one of the genes. The chances that these two carrier parents will actually have a child with the affected condition would be 1 in 4, with 2 of the children being carrier children and then 1 being unaffected. And so I'll talk a little bit about autosomal recessive, which, you know, it's one of those things that we're frequently criticized for missing alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, at least early on, because it's, you know, frequently misdiagnosed as asthma. And, again, it's an autosomal recessive condition. And then, you know, the emphysema that you'll typically see on the x-rays is more of a basilar you know, distribution as opposed to more of an apical distribution. So a basilar emphysema, you know, is one of those classic signs of alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency and frequently missed as an asthma condition. Now, cystic fibrosis, also autosomal recessive, and there's an association with intussusception with abdominal pain. So I guess one of the questions they could give you is that, you know, if you had a, you know, probably more of a pediatrics type of question, but I guess it could be an internal medicine question, but you have that patient with abdominal pain with cystic fibrosis, you know, what's one of the differentials? Well, the answer would be, you know, intussusception. And obviously they may give you, you know, Pseudomonas. I think everybody knows that there's this classic association between Pseudomonas and CF. But if you see Burkholderia sepatiae, that bacteria, it's very commonly associated with CF. I don't think there's too many other conditions that you classically will see this pathologically. So, you know, Burkholderia sepatiae, you know, think cystic fibrosis. So another autosomal recessive condition is hemochromatosis that has hook-like osteophytes in the second and third metacarpal phalangeal joints. I don't have the X-ray here, but you could actually just do a quick Google image search and see those X-rays. I'm sure we probably all have seen those hook-like osteophytes in the second and third MCP joints, and that's kind of like one of those classic things for hemochromatosis. Of course, the screen, most people, I think, use the transferrin saturation. You typically have a very high transferrin saturation in patients with hemochromatosis, more than 45%. And then you can do the genetic testing, which is, it's not cheap, right? But you can do the testing for HFE gene nowadays if they do have that very high transferrin saturation in patients with hemochromatosis. The next is sickle cell anemia with a valglute for glutamic acid. And I won't spend too much time on sickle cell because I think you had a little bit of this in your the hematology section. It's always kind of interesting with sickle cell. There's actually a protective effect against malaria, and that's the reason why worldwide geography you see the origins of people with sickle cell in areas where it has a more higher malaria predominance, at least historically. Now, for the thalassemias, one thing I think is very helpful, if they do give you a hemoglobin electrophoresis, you look for what's missing. And thalassemias are named for what is missing. And I think that's sometimes always very helpful to, remember for the thalassemias. So for Wilson's disease, obviously they have that the liver, the liver component of it, and they typically have the, psychiatric, component of the Wilson's disease, autosomal recessive. But the gene that you can test for nowadays is the ATP7B gene. So for patients with Wilson's disease, if they give you, ask you the question, which of the following genes are affecting Wilson's disease, ATP7B gene would be the answer. So I'll spend just a couple minutes talking about some X-linked recessive conditions. And these are the X-linked recessive conditions. And just to, give you the little cartoon for it, if the father, is the affected father, meaning that he has, the X, on his X gene, and then he has children with an unaffected mother, the chances that the children will have it, typically it'll be the two daughters would actually get it. The two daughters would actually get the, become carriers. The sons would not get it, right, because they get their X from their mother. And then if the daughters would then have children, there would be a 50-50 chance that those children would get it. So that's why, like the old thing, it skips a generation type of thing, because they're talking about the X-linked recessive, like kind of a historical reason why they talk about that. So the next condition is G6PD, which is X-linked recessive. And they typically have a shorter red blood cell lifespan. Occurs in about 10% of African-American males. And, they always have that laundry list. There's a lot of medications that can cause G6PD. So if you do have a person that you think that is, having, G6PD, associated, condition, obviously you got to ask about, the anti-malarials. That's like one of those classic things, anti-malarials, that always sticks in everybody's mind. But probably more frequently is NSAIDs and aspirin, right? So all of a sudden somebody has this hematological condition, associated with taking some ibuprofen, you have to think, could it be from G6PD, particularly if they're African-American males. So the next condition is that's also X-linked recessive is hemophilia A's and B's. Again, it's almost exclusively male because it is X-linked recessive, typically diagnosed at a very young age. The hemophilic arthropathies is a major condition. It's very debilitating. These patients with hemophilia, just very minor trauma, bump your knee into something, or if you're, kneeling to pray or whatever, you can have some hemarthrosis, and then, over time, those hemarthrosis, you can actually develop a hemophilic arthropathy. So, very, important condition to recognize. And these are the mitochondrial conditions. You see some of these from time to time. I had one time a person with Milos syndrome. Has the metabolic encephalopathy and episodes of lactic acidosis and stroke. Actually, the patient was admitted for a stroke and, had a high end and got metabolic acidosis. And turns out he actually knew he had Milos syndrome from mitochondrial mutations. So